Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Lost in Science for another week. This is, of course, half an hour on your radio. Sit back, relax, get yourselves comfortable because we've got 30 minutes of the 30 minutes of science coming up for you. Things that'll interest you, things that might even blow your mind. And with me on the show this week is Stu. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Claire. I'm always ready to blow people's minds, it's got to be said.
I mean, I'm here for it. That's why I keep turning up each week. What have you got for us?
Well, this week I'm going to get mossed in science. Just going to be looking into the world of moss. It's pretty fascinating stuff.
We've been doing this for a while, and I can't think of a time you've done a story on moss. But you are a plant guy and a fun guy, and so I am very excited to hear your take on what makes moss interesting.
So much that makes it interesting. But you know, and it's also something that we're still finding out new things about, which is what I'm going to be talking about a little bit later on too.
Gosh, yeah. Who would have thought? Not everything there is to know about moss has been discovered yet.
Yeah. It's you know, it's so common, it's everywhere, it's all over the place, but we still don't know everything there is to know about moss.
Brilliant.
And that's our loss.
It's our moss loss. Mm. Yeah. Well, I am going to be looking at some new research that has been published recently, and it is about fluoride in water. Topic can be incredibly controversial and even more controversial in the US at the moment, but there has been a incredibly long longitudinal study of the effects of fluoride in the water, and spoiler alert, it's fine. But anyway, I'm going to take us through that research and just sort of give us a bit of an overview of what fluoride in the water does and, you know, all the rest of it and why it's such a safe and reliable and equitable public health initiative.
Sounds great. Keep smiling.
Keep smiling for all those mosses out there. I don't know. I can't think of a good moss pun. Who am I kidding? On with the show.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science. Now, one of the most common forms of plant life on Earth is usually found right under our noses, or probably more accurately, right under our feet. You could even say we tend to walk all over it. I'm talking about mosses, which are collectively called bryophytes, and I looked this up to find out what it means. Basically, it's ancient Greek for moss plant.
Moss plant.
So the moss plants are called moss plants. also includes things like liverworts, which are also in the same division. And these are very...
Hang on. You said liverwort. Is it liverwort, is it? I've seen the word written, and it looks like wort.
It's liverwort.
Okay, all right. Just that's if my you first be, brain explosion. Yeah. Thank you very much, Stu.
Should be pronounced liverwort, but everyone reads it as liverwort because that's how it's spelled. Anyway, They're also in with the mosses in bryophytes. And I don't think the ancient Greeks distinguished between mosses and liverworts. They just went, they're the green stuff on the ground. And unless you look closely, moss is pretty much just green fuzz. It's not doing a lot out when it's growing out there in the world. It's usually found in low light environments and usually in very damp places. And that's not to say
it checks out with what I understand moss to be.
Yeah. And it's not to say it couldn't grow in other places. It's just that it usually gets outcompeted by bigger plants.
All right.
They're capable of extracting water and nutrients in a more efficient way. They cast more shade. They grow taller. All of those things, the moss can't compete with those. And part of the reason is that the early ancestors of mosses were probably the first plants to grow on land without being completely surrounded in water like algae are. So the mosses got out of the water, but, you know, they could only kind of survive in places where there was lots of water around. And being the first plants, they didn't have any competition, so they kind of spread all over the place. And there was no other plants to compete with. It wasn't until much later that these other plants came around. So in order to move on to land, moss had to be able to extract water from the environment to survive. And moss has these tiny rudimentary root-like structures called rhizoids on the bottom of it.
Rhizoids.
Yeah, which means root-like, basically. But unlike roots, rhizoids are only a few cells in length. So they don't grow into the soil or anything. They're just kind of like touching the surface that they're growing on. And that's why the moss is restricted to areas that are wet all the time, because they can't bring water like roots can.
Uh-huh.
They have to have the water right there. They also, once they absorb it, they can't move it very far. So they have no vascular tissue like plants that evolved later. They've got no way of moving the water, which is why they're little tiny little plants.
Right. So when you say the vascular tissue, you're talking about like the xylem and the phloem, like the tubes that extend up and down the stems and stuff like that. They don't have any of that. It just sort of moves from cell to cell.
It kind of moves. It's a water potential gradient. So it moves up. Just the drier the cell, the more water it absorbs. That's kind of how it works. Wow. Very, very simple. Yeah. There are simple ways it can move water, but it's not efficient like a xylem vessel or something like that can move it, 100 meters up a eucalyptus tree or something like that. They don't have anything like that. And this is, they're very small. They can't move water very far, so they're stuck in these low, in these areas where there's available water all the time. Mosses are also weirdly backwards in their life cycle compared to most of the plants that we see most of the time. The dominant stage of the life cycle of the plant in moss is the gametophyte stage. So the equivalent in flowering plants would be the pollen or the egg.
Mm-hmm.
But that's in moss, the gametophyte is the green part that you see. The green fuzzy bit is the gametophyte. So it's only got half the chromosomes of the moss.
Wow. And so gametes, that's like the sex cells, right?
Yeah.
So in humans, it's like eggs and sperm. So all the green part that you see is the gametes.
Yes.
Wow.
And
do they photosynthesize?
Yeah, so the gametophytes are the photosynthetic part. The sporophyte is a non-photosynthetic structure that develops when the green parts produce sperm and eggs. So the green bit produces the sperm and eggs. They combine, they produce the little, you probably see them. If you look at moss, you see the little stalk with a little spore capsule on the end. That's the sporophyte. That's the equivalent of like an apple tree, except it doesn't grow. It just produces spores. That's all it does. So they're quite backwards. They're quite odd little plants. Now, considering how simple the mosses are, they're very resilient, and they show a degree of, or very, or demonstrate a great degree of totipotency, which is the ability to grow into a whole plant from a single cell. So, you know, they can be broken up and little fragments of moss can regrow into fully grown moss plants. Now, some species, you can even completely dry them out, grind them up into a powder, scatter it all around, and then if you re-wet it, they'll all grow back into moss. All the little fragments and ground up bits of moss will grow back into moss plants again. So they're fully resilient plants. They can survive a lot. So in 2013, some samples of moss fragments were collected at the receding edge of glaciers in Canada, and they were successfully revived in vitro under lab conditions, which backed up observations in the field that mosses had regrown after being frozen for over 400 years under the glacier.
Wow.
So they rebounded from that and just started growing again after 400 years in the freezer. There's a species of moss found in the Australian desert that can survive in temperatures in excess of 50 degrees Celsius, but it's also same species found in Antarctica where it tolerates temperatures below minus 40 degrees Celsius.
Same species.
Yeah. So just absolutely
holy moly.
Tough guys. Absolute tough guys.
That, what would be even wackier is if you didn't find it anywhere else.
Just except in the desert and in Antarctica.
Minus 40. Yeah.
Yeah, no, they kind of obviously can grow in between as well. I mean, they're probably not that happy growing in 50 degrees Celsius or minus 40, but they can handle it. Now, knowing all this about the ability of moss to survive and regenerate after being exposed to extreme conditions has led some space exploration researchers to wonder if they might be useful in colonizing, or might be useful as colonizing species on other planets. So maybe we could send moss out to places where there's no plant life and they might be able to survive and grow. So to test the hypothesis that moss could survive in places that most other plants would curl up and die, some Japanese researchers shot some into space. Well,
wow.
More exactly, they placed some moss spores on the outside of their test module. On the outside, mind you.
On the outside?
Yeah, on the International Space Station. They left it in orbit for 9 months, a bit over 9 months. And when they recovered their samples and brought them back to Earth, they found that over 80% of the spores were able to grow into normal, healthy moss plants. So,
but the things they've seen.
Well, they've seen the world. And now,
they've
and,
seen the world now, many, many times.
And now they're just going to grow 3 centimetres tall on the ground again. What a disappointing ending. No, but look, you know, they're still monitoring the moss and they're genetically testing it to see if it has any genetic or developmental abnormalities after being exposed to the vacuum and the extreme temperatures and massive doses of UV radiation. But so far, it all appears completely normal. They're just growing normally. So, you know, they can survive a trip to space and come back alive. Now, can you think of another organism, Claire, that we know can survive a trip to space?
Water bears?
Water bears, right?
Now, tardigrades.
Tardigrades. We know tardigrades can survive space travel and cold and heat and extreme desiccation. Do you know what another name for water bears is?
What is it? Tell me it's something to do with moss.
It's moss piglets.
Oh!
So not only can we colonize space with our little tardigrade friends, we can actually send them off with something to eat while they're out there. So on Earth, water bears, tardigrades, you can find them in huge numbers just everywhere. There's, I think, about 200,000 per square meter in normal soil. But in moss, you get like 2 million tardigrades per square meter in moss patches. So the tardigrades are happy in space. Well, not necessarily happy, but they can survive in space. But we can send them some moss to eat as well. So, I mean, this is you know, groundbreaking research for putting tardigrades on other planets with something to eat. And we've got a whole ecosystem ready to roll. It's pretty fantastic.
I love it.
Yeah.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. If we wish to make it louder, we will bring up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we will tune it to a whisper. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter. We can change the focus to a soft blur or sharpen it to crystal clarity. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. We repeat, there is nothing wrong with your television set. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
So, Stu, everywhere you look or hear these days, it seems like decades-old public health initiatives that have time and time again been proven to be safe and cost-effective and reliable and equitable, they seem to be under attack. And one of these initiatives that's under attack most recently in the US by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is the addition of fluoride into drinking water.
Yeah.
Now, unsurprisingly, RFK he's making moves to stop the Center for Disease Control from recommending fluoride in the water. And already the state of Utah has banned fluoride in water altogether. So some pretty serious things, and some public health initiatives being stopped in their tracks already. But so with this sort of incredibly political background, it's pretty fascinating that this week there's been a new longitudinal study published that's decades in the making, showing that there is no link between fluoride in the water and cognitive issues, sort of like a decline in IQ seems to be what all the proponents arguing against fluoride say, that there's a decline in IQ when fluoride's in the water. So there's no link between fluoride in the water and a decline in cognitive issues. So this is the largest study of its kind and worth going into. But before we do, let me give you a little bit of a lowdown on fluoridation, as it's called.
Yeah.
Adding fluoride to water. So the US government began adding fluoride to water in 1945. So it's not like it's been a recent thing. It's been quite a long public health initiative. And then Australia adopted it in 1953. So we came on board a couple of years later. And today, fluoridation occurs in about 70% of Australian drinking water. So it's not everywhere, but it's in a solid amount.
Yeah.
And so why was it added? Well, there's overwhelming scientific evidence showing that fluoride in drinking water lowers the risk of tooth decay in children and adults. Mm. So stops cavities, stops tooth decay. And in fact, putting fluoride in drinking water, it's so effective that the US Center for Disease Control has previously recognized it as one of the 10 great public health interventions of the 20th century. So this is a big one. And to understand the mechanism of how it works, remember back to your tooth decay education days. I don't know whether you ever, maybe when you first went to the dentist.
Yeah.
So tooth decay happens when bacteria in your mouth eat sugar and make acid. That acid dissolves your tooth enamel faster than your saliva can repair it, and that's how cavities are formed. So fluoride just tips the balance back. So when there's a little bit of fluoride in your saliva, it helps your enamel repair itself faster, It forms a tougher, more acid-resistant coating on your teeth, and it slows down how quick cavities can develop. So it literally like remineralizes your teeth, which makes sense given fluoride is a naturally occurring mineral, right?
Makes perfect sense.
Makes perfect sense. So that's why fluoride, it's been a very simple and effective public health tool. It's cheap, it's passive, it reaches every demographic. So it's equitable in all senses of the word as well. But despite all this evidence for improved health outcomes in children, in adults, the safety of fluoride has been debated for almost 80 years. So recently there's been an argument against fluoride that's focused on a couple of small studies that have linked fluoride exposure to lower IQ levels in children. But much of the research focuses on extremely high levels of fluoride, so much higher than the Australian and the American standard levels that you see in water fluoridation, so really high levels of toxicity. And just to bring in a dental research professor for a moment here, Professor Lochdo from the University of Queensland, he was asked about this week, about these studies, and commented that most of the studies that were conducted, they didn't control for other factors. For example, some of the places were really naturally high in fluoride levels already, or they had heavy metal contaminants in their water supply, so they didn't adjust for the fact that there was heavy metal contaminants. No larger studies have been able to replicate the link between low IQ and fluoride.
I mean, it's an interesting angle to be coming from, though. Is like, so what are you saying about the people of Utah, RFK? You know, you're suggesting that the entire state has got a lower IQ than it should, and blaming fluoride for it? Is that basically what he's saying? You know,
I mean. I could not guess what he is saying at any one time, Stu. I cannot guess.
It may be the brain worm speaking.
Yeah, indeed. But anyway, this is where we come to with the new research. So it's a major research. It's decades long. It was led by a researcher named John Robert Warren. And this research group followed 26,820 people, like young people, from 1,020 high schools. And as the researchers say, this was a representative sample across the US. So this is, this is representative of high schools and demographics and people all over the country. And then participants were tracked throughout the study between 1980 and 2021. So they're now around 60 years old. So this, well, when it was 2021, they were around 60 years old, and that's when the study sort of completed. And the researchers compared cognitive testing results when they were adolescents, so reading comprehension, mathematics, vocab, and then they followed up with a subset of the cohort across the 40 years, a representative subset. And they compared the cognitive testing with the local fluoridation practices. So what the area that they lived in, how they fluoridated their water, and they looked at the actual fluoride levels in drinking water, and they also looked at data from geological surveys to get a sense of naturally occurring fluoride as well, to sort of like see how the fluoridation affected their whether there was any effect on their IQ. And what they found was there was no evidence that exposure to the recommended fluoride levels, so that's 0.7 milligrams per litre, impaired childhood cognition. There was no evidence of fluoride causing cognitive decline later in adulthood. In fact, interesting, there was slightly better cognition scores in early life for those with fluoride in the water. But the effect was pretty small and it disappeared as people aged, so there didn't seem to be any long-term difference either way. But pretty much, like, this seems to be, like, the best evidence that community-level fluoride exposure does not harm the brain. And, you know, why having reliable, solid evidence matters so much for our public health. Because, you know, dental disease, it's widespread, and going to the dentist costs a lot of money, and that's not getting cheaper anytime soon. So anything low cost and clever and safe and reliable that we can do, we should be doing.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things I find interesting too is that a lot of the anti-fluoridation people will say, well, lots of European countries don't put fluoride in their water and lots of other countries don't put fluoride in their water. But there's a lot of countries who do other things. Like there's countries who put fluoride in salt, for example. There's countries who put fluoride in milk. And they're getting the benefits of fluoridation, just not in the drinking water because they're finding it easier to put it in other products. And the other thing that I've noticed too is that people point and say, well, lots of countries in Europe don't have fluoridation in their water supplies, but the countries that don't have terrible dental health. So you're right. There are countries in Europe who don't have fluoridation and they don't get the benefit from it, which is that you get better teeth.
And that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And that's it for another episode of Lost in Science. Lost in Science is recorded for 3CR in Melbourne on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And it airs across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We would love you to get in touch with us. You can email us at lostinsci@gmail.com or you can find us on Facebook, we're Lost in Science on 3CR, or on Twitter, where we're at LostInScience1. You can find us on your favourite podcast app where, if you get the chance, please give us a good rating and review, as that will raise us up in the search rankings so other people can find the science. Or you can listen to us however you listen to us now, where the same time every week, Claire, Stu and Chris get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.